Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling back with you, and with me, as always, my partner in crime, Brandon Odo.
Yo.
We're going to talk about something that Brandon and I both have an interest in today, which is point-of-care ultrasound, but a little bit of a twist. I think most of the time in the ICU, we think about ultrasound from a cardiac standpoint, or maybe lung ultrasound. And, of course, the ED guys... we'll often think of abdomen in terms of the fast and stuff like that, but we're actually going to look at point of care ultrasound from the position of the kidneys, of a renal issue. And so we have with us Dr. Abhilash Koratala, who's an associate professor of medicine and the director of the clinical imaging for nephrology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, if I can get all these big words out. He is an internationally recognized expert in point-of-care ultrasound, particularly in the hemodynamic assessment using Doppler techniques. And you may know him if you are online and have seen his website, nephropocus.com, or seen him on Twitter, because he's on there frequently talking about POCUS from a nephrology standpoint. So welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you. I mean, this is such a... obviously, we do a lot of ultrasound in general in the ICU, but this sort of niche of using it in the nephrology world is, I think something that most people haven't developed nearly as much as you. So we're really interested to see that perspective, but also just the actual applications you're using, which a lot of, I think, really are applicable to us as well. We looked at some of these topics going way back. One of our first shows with... Philippe Rolla, looking at things like the VEXA scan, so people can dig back into the archives if you want to get some of that material. But you know, new year, new topic. So I'm going to introduce you to a patient that you see on your consult nephrology service in the hospital. It's a 66-year-old male, and this guy has a history of chronic kidney disease. They were calling it stage 3. He has hypertension, a little bit of heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction. And he came to the hospital with what they thought was community-acquired pneumonia. He was initially admitted to the ICU. He was, at the time, fairly ill. He was on vasopressors, but only for a short time, less than a day. Quickly, he was able to be weaned. He received about 4.5 liters of fluid from various sources the first 24 hours there. Got off his pressors. He was placed on a little bit of oral midodrine, and he was transferred out to the floors after about a day and a half in the ICU on 4 liters of oxygen, reasonably stable. However, what is not doing so well is his renal function. His creatinine at his normal baseline is about in the 2 range, and when he first came to the hospital here, it was 3.1. So they thought he had just acute kidney injury from his critical illness and sepsis and, you know, as we say, multifactorial. But even though he's left the ICU, over the first 3 days or so in the hospital, his creatinine has continued to trend up. It's now right about 4, low 4 range. BUN is about 65. His urine output is about 20 cc's an hour. So he's making urine, but not all that much. He's still on 4 liters of oxygen, and his most recent chest x-ray today has sort of scattered interstitial-looking changes. They think some of it is pulmonary edema, although some of it, no doubt, is from his pneumonia. He had a formal echocardiogram his first day when he was admitted, which was sort of technically limited, but his EF was about 50% then. There was grade 1 diastolic dysfunction and mild to moderate tricuspid regurgitation. So the ICU team is no longer involved, but you are, as the nephrology team. And the medical team taking care of him, what their primary concern and question is we see this worsening acute kidney injury, and we're trying to decide what to do about his volume status. Should we diurese him? Should we not? In some ways, they think he's volume overloaded, but they're leery of the idea of trying to take any volume off, if they're even going to be able to, with this AKI. On paper, meaning if you add up his ins and outs, he's positive about 5.5 liters since he's been admitted. Never mind any insensible losses. You go and see him, and you find him in bed in his kind of floor room. He's breathing comfortably. He's sitting about 91% on his 4 liters of oxygen. He has mild but certainly present pitting edema in all four arms and legs. That's right, his forearms and his 4 legs. Now, the floor team was aware of this, but, you know, they were raising the question, maybe he is sort of overloaded, all things considered, but intravascularly on the dry side, whatever that means. You can't appreciate his jugular veins. His abdomen is soft. He does not have a Foley catheter, which was removed yesterday at the patient's request. So, a lot of data, but in many ways, a probably pretty typical patient with AKI after critical illness. I'm probably curious your overall take on a patient like this, but I'm particularly curious if there is a role for the use of bedside ultrasound to help you understand this sort of patient.
Certainly, as you pointed out, it's not really an uncommon scenario. We see it all the time on the floors, not only in the patients who are transferred out of ICU, but who are just admitted to the floor and being managed there. And there is always a role for point-of-care ultrasound in acute kidney injury evaluation. And when you think about a patient with acute kidney injury, we generally go by the same mental framework as the pre-renal, post-renal, and intrinsic renal. And because it's easy to rule out things. Like in the post-renal scenario, you do a quick kidney ultrasound and bladder ultrasound and exclude ongoing urinary obstruction. Just because the patient didn't have urinary obstruction on initial ultrasound, it does not mean that he or she doesn't have it after a few days of hospital stay, especially when there is no Foley catheter. We cannot be sure. And sometimes even if the patient has a Foley catheter, you can have bladder debris causing obstruction of the catheter and causing urinary obstruction. So that's the simplest thing to do at the bedside, look at the kidneys and bladder and make sure there is no obstruction. After ruling out obstruction, we go to his lungs. So I would do a quick lung ultrasound to get an idea of the extent of the interstitial edema, and then do the inferior vena cava ultrasound to see if there is an elevated right atrial pressure or not. And if there is a right atrial pressure, then I would do a VEXAS assessment, which is a Doppler assessment of the systemic veins, to see if you are seeing the flow alteration in the systemic veins, suggestive of congestive kidney injury.
Okay, so let's go through this step by step then. You would start with the lungs, in fact. And of course, there are other ways to look at this, but you're mainly looking for pulmonary edema.
Yeah, we start with the lung ultrasound. It's not necessarily because pulmonary edema is directly hurting the kidney function. It's because we tend to think about possible volume depletion in any case of AKI. And if the patient has B lines in the lung, it tells you that the patient is not fluid tolerant. In case you are contemplating empiric intravenous fluid therapy, it might be always a good idea to look at the lungs and make sure there is no fluid, because by giving empiric fluids, which may or may not be necessary, you would probably be exacerbating existing pulmonary edema.
Now, is this because pulmonary edema is a clinically relevant but separate harm from acute kidney injury? Or is this because pulmonary edema due to fluid overload, if that's the word we want to use, tends to go with kidney injury from fluid overload? In other words, it's hard to have one without the other.
Right, exactly. In most of the instances, like you mentioned, like fluid overload goes along with the B lines in the lungs, as well as increased right atrial pressure. And there are scenarios where they can be discordant also. This patient had heart failure with preserved ejection fraction before he was fluid resuscitated, it's quite possible that he already had some pulmonary edema. And on top of that, we did this aggressive fluid resuscitation leading to increased right atrial pressure. So yeah, so basically B lines in the lung can suggest overall fluid overload state, which may or may not be directly related to AKI. And it can also mean that the patient developed AKI and consequently had fluid and sodium retention, and that predisposed in a predisposed individual that caused pulmonary edema. And it can also mean that the same patient will also have coexisting congestive nephropathy because of coexisting systemic venous congestion.
Okay, so the volume status of the lungs tends to correlate with the volume status of the kidneys, not necessarily, but it is some kind of data, and it is its own relevant data. If you came to a place where you had to hurt one to help the other, you know, you'd at least want to know what you're doing.
Right. Basically, it changes management, whether it's etiologically related to kidney injury or not. So it would change how you would probably treat this patient in case you're contemplating any empiric treatment.
Okay. And as a nephrologist doing a bedside ultrasound, what do you do? You're looking for B-lines. You know, how many fields are you looking in? Are you counting them? What's your approach?
We are primarily looking at cardiogenic pulmonary edema. So we do like 8-zone lung ultrasound, meaning 2 anterior and 2 lateral on each hemithorax. Because we are typically not looking for B-line secondary to interstitial pneumonia or pathologies that affect posterior aspects of the lung. We typically don't sonoauscultate the posterior zones.
So you can rationally just look at sort of the most accessible fields on the front and sides.
Right. And also you would essentially cover the dependent zones by doing lateral zones on the right and the left, and the right and the lateral lower zones will cover the pleural effusion component.
And how are you quantifying what you see?
We don't like really have hard cutoffs or anything. I know studies use like more than 10 B lines in these 8 zones might be bad, and so on. But in general, like if you tend to see B lines in more than one dependent zone, it's probably the patient can be further decongested, assuming there is it's all cardiogenic component and there is no pre-existing lung disease or ongoing pneumonia-like illness.
So by and large, accepting maybe some focal findings that you think might have another cause, if there are any B lines, you're putting them into the category where these are lungs with some cardiogenic pulmonary edema, and if there are none, then they're in a different category.
Right. Yeah, in the overall clinical context, this patient has no pneumonia, your index patient. So he or she's on antibiotics anyways. You can't do anything about it. But on top of that, you have evidence of increased extravascular lung water. You would be cautious with giving empiric fluids.
So you looked at the lungs and then you said your next step would be the IVC. IVC ultrasound is an area of, you know, controversy in our world, depending on the application you're using. So what are the questions you're trying to answer here and how are you answering them?
So the primary role of inferior vena cava ultrasound is to estimate right atrial pressure. That's essentially the sole purpose here. The controversies in the ICU are because, like, one of the reasons is that you cannot trust it to estimate right atrial pressure in mechanically ventilated patients. And the other thing is the literature is divided about, like, what's the purpose of IVC ultrasound? Is it to evaluate fluid responsiveness versus estimate right atrial pressure? And if you think the patient is fluid responsive, should you give fluids versus or not? These are all the ICU-related controversies. But when the patient is on the ward who is not intubated, I think IVC is a fairly reliable tool to estimate their right atrial pressure, at least to categorize as to high versus low. If you really have a patient who you cannot utilize inferior vena cava, you can always use internal jugular vein. For example, in a patient with cirrhosis, because of local structural alterations, you might not be able to use IVC, so you can use internal jugular vein. But the point here is after looking at the lungs, which indicate left-sided cardiac pressures, we look at the inferior vena cava, which is an indicator of right-sided cardiac pressures. And just by looking at the vessel, if it's a plethoric versus not, we get some sense of the right atrial pressure.
Okay, so the main question you're asking is, I see this IVC, does it look plethoric or no? That's kind of your main dichotomy there.
Exactly. That way, like, if it's not plethoric, it does not mean the patient needs fluids, but if there are no significant B lines in the lung and the IVC is not plethoric, that tells you that the patient might be fluid tolerant. And if you want to give fluids empirically, it might be justified, excluding rare cases where, you know, with the recent data, we know that even people with not elevated central venous pressure, they might not be responsive to fluids. So leaving aside, like, the minor proportion of patients on the floor with the resources that we have and with not many people being familiar with POCUS, and we might not be able to monitor these patients continuously, it's a rational assumption to make that if the patient is fluid tolerant, the right atrial pressure is not elevated, there is no significantly increased extravascular lung water, it's probably okay to infuse fluids.
Are you measuring these IVCs?
Yes. So look at the anteroposterior diameter as well as collapsibility.
And do you have a particular cutoff for those?
So we generally follow the American Society of Echocardiography guidelines because these guidelines were formulated in the outpatient setting. So they are reasonably applicable to the ward setting as well, as opposed to ICU. We use more than or less than 2.1 centimeters as the maximal diameter cutoff for the IVC. If the IVC is more than 2.1 centimeters and less than 50% collapsible with a deep inspiration, that's considered elevated right atrial pressure, estimated to be approximately 15 millimeters mercury. Obviously, we have to be vigilant about like the inspiratory collapsibility. Like, are we just looking at patients' regular breathing, or are we looking at deep inspiration? Because by definition, inspiratory collapsibility is with a sniff. That's one thing we tend to ignore. As a patient is regularly breathing, we tend to assess the collapsibility. And if it's 40%, it does not necessarily mean the right atrial pressure is elevated. You should always ask the patient to sniff. But again, like even if the patient sniffs, the hospitalized patients are sick. A 30-year-old muscular man's strength of breath is different from 80-year-old frail woman's strength of breath. So all these factors must be taken into consideration. So yeah, we go by case-by-case basis on that.
In this context, it sounds like the main thing you're asking is this a large, minimally collapsing IVC or not? Or is it in some other gray area? And then maybe you'll go other ways. But in the context here where we're, just like we were saying, are there B-lines or not, essentially? Is this a big IVC or not?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So assuming that, let's say this patient has a few B-lines here and there, we look at their IVC and it's, you know, 2.2 centimeters. It's varying maybe 10, 20% at most with a reasonable inspiration. You said you would then go on to do a VEXA scan. Is that right?
Right.
And, you know, we've explored this a little bit in the past, if we can refer viewers to, but essentially using some Doppler modalities of the solid organs in the abdomen to understand their flow characteristics a little bit. How do you approach it? Are you looking at hepatic veins, portal veins, the renal veins and arteries, and you're sort of doing everything on everyone?
Right. If the patient has elevated right atrial pressure, the next thing you think about is this elevated right atrial pressure affecting the organ flow or the perfusion at the end organ level? Because you can have a patient with elevated right atrial pressure of 10 millimeters mercury, but maybe there are no flow alterations in this vein. So it might be difficult to tie this elevated right atrial pressure to impaired organ perfusion or acute kidney injury or congestive nephropathy, more precisely. And in the original VEXA study, they compared the incidence of AKI. They took only like elevated central venous pressure of more than or equal to 12 millimeters mercury and assess the risk of AKI versus the full VEXA score, which includes all the veins you mentioned, hepatic vein Doppler, portal vein Doppler, and intrarenal venous Doppler. When they used that combination score, the risk of development of AKI was substantially higher compared to central venous pressure alone. So this Doppler grading gives you additional information in addition to IVC ultrasound or central venous pressure measurement. Yeah, we use all the three veins whenever possible. And sometimes like intrarenal vein might be difficult to get. So if it's taking too much time, we won't do it. But at least we do hepatic and portal veins.
And, you know, some people have asked, I know we have asked, what information does it add to do this sort of scan? So in a patient like this, probably just before you walk in the room, your pretest probability is that this patient has relatively high venous pressures. Despite these other considerations like, oh, they have AKI and so on. But now that you've looked at their lungs, you look at their IVC, probably your suspicion for that is even higher. So in that context, what question are we answering with the VEXA scan? Is it that if the VEXA scan supports a significant degree of venous congestion that's impacting these organs. And again, I refer people to the details, but basically we're saying that at the higher the pressures and the less tolerance and compliance there is in the venous system, the more you start to see kind of changes in how flow moves through these vessels and how much pressure is reflected and some things like that. But is the implication for you that if there are signs of a lot of venous congestion, then it would support the theory kidney-wise that congestion is worsening the renal function? Whereas if you had a pretty normal-looking scan, despite these other findings like the IVC, you might say, well, probably this patient is not hypovolemic, meaning I don't think we're going to cure their AKI with fluid, but I also don't think it's necessarily being worsened by volume overload. Is that sort of how you would approach it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That makes sense. That like, yeah, like you mentioned, the pretest probability is already high, but doing VEXAS will help me with two things. One thing, as I mentioned, like you can have elevated central venous pressure, but also not necessarily severely altered waveforms that were associated with acute kidney injury or mortality, right? And so you're establishing the diagnosis there. So I can confidently put in my note that this patient likely has congestive nephropathy on top of acute tubular injury. Improvement in the acute kidney injury might be delayed because of these ongoing insults. And the second thing that really helps me, VEXAS helps me, is in monitoring the efficacy of therapy. Because from a floor doctor's perspective, you want to decongest the patient fully before you discharge the patient so that you can potentially avoid heart failure readmissions, which is a big thing in terms of healthcare costs and resource utilization. It's been found that patients who are discharged from the hospital without being decongested, they could have some B lines in the lungs or maybe they still have a big inferior vena cava, they tend to be admitted back to the hospital sooner. So from that perspective, I can watch the transition of these waveforms in real time as I do the diuretic therapy or if the patient is on dialysis, you do mechanical ultrafiltration and see the changes on a day-to-day basis and make sure the patient is optimally decongested by the time of discharge. So basically, in summary, VEXAS not only helps you to diagnose congestive nephropathy, but also allows you to monitor the efficacy of decongestive therapy.
Okay, so it's sort of an additional layer of information on top of these other approaches, clinical exam and things like the IVC and other lab tests, which kind of gives you more precise assessment of, okay, yeah, sure, this patient is on the volume overloaded side, but what does that mean? To what extent is it severe? To what extent is it contributing to these other problems like their kidney function? And that degree of precision may or may not be necessary depending on the question you're asking, but it could be. For instance, as you said, as you treat, let's say we're diuresing or we're ultrafiltering the patient. All right, when are we done? Other people would use things like, is there peripheral edema? How much oxygen are they on? Or how do their lungs look on something like x-ray? If they're really being fancy, maybe on ultrasound. But maybe this is more precise than those things. Perhaps they still have edema or they don't, but being able to appreciate progressive improvement in something like their VEXAS scan is a much more precise marker of changes from, let's say, one day to another.
Right, exactly. I would say that VEXAS is a right-sided parameter. So if you're just solely relying on lung ultrasound or oxygen saturation, so the patients can improve in terms of lung. Maybe they have ongoing venous congestion. That's one thing. And the other thing is, it's not always that pedal edema correlates well with venous congestion. So you can have a patient who doesn't have any pedal edema but has severe congestion in terms of Doppler waveforms. On the other hand, you can have a patient who has long-standing edema but doesn't seem to have severe congestion. It's probably they have lymphatic dysfunction, which is not unheard of, which is not uncommon in patients with heart failure. because of the structural alterations to lymphatics. And also, like, there are a subset of patients who are more complicated than routine heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. They have pulmonary hypertension and tricuspid regurgitation. In those cases, you can probably rely solely on even inferior vena cava, because the inferior vena cava might be chronically dilated. And if you observe portal vein and its relationship with other veins, such as hepatic vein or intrarenal vein or femoral vein, even in certain cases, that might be that might give you a better idea of how well you have decongested the patient and when to probably stop it, because your goal is not always necessarily to normalize all these waveforms. Because by the time you discharge these patients, in reality, you can normalize portal vein waveform, or you can see improvement in portal vein pulsatility in most cases. But hepatic vein may or may not normalize. In most cases, it does. But if the patient has pulmonary hypertension and tricuspid regurgitation, reduced longitudinal excursion of the right ventricle, you might still see a little bit of abnormal hepatic vein flow. And the renal vein flow, or more specifically intrarenal or renal parenchymal venous flow, is the last one to improve because interstitial edema in the kidney takes some time to resolve. So, yeah, as you do more of these scans, we tend to get a better idea of like when how to assess each of these individual waveforms as well as the combined score.
I gave you a patient who was stable. They're out of the ICU. They're not in shock, at least perceptibly. But maybe this would be even more complicated if it were otherwise. So maybe this patient is still in the ICU, still on vasopressors, for instance. And now people would be particularly leery about taking any intravascular volume away from them. In many cases, they would still be giving some to them. And you said that this approach focuses on the right heart and the venous system. To what extent can we apply that to the left heart and the arterial outputs? For instance, someone might come and say, listen, I believe what you're saying, there's venous congestion, the right heart has an elevated filling pressure, but this patient is in shock and their left heart still needs as much filling as it can get. Can I still give them fluid to support the left heart, so to speak, without further harming the organs? Are these sort of related concepts, or can you have approach them separately? Could you have a patient who might indeed benefit from additional preload for the left heart, and yet it would also harm the venous system in the right heart? How do we approach these?
So if the patient is on vasopressors, it does not necessarily mean the patient is volume depleted, right? So it could be a vasodilatory variant of the shock. And if such a patient has venous congestion, you can still give diuretics and continue vasopressors. And about the left ventricular preload, if you really have that much congestion, say if you have a patient with severe venous congestion and you're worried about reduced left ventricular filling still, probably your problem is in the lung. Like the lung is not, lung is acting as a resistance site here because the hemodynamic circuit should be continuous. There is no reason why all the venous system is filled up and the arterial system is empty. So you're probably dealing with a situation where the patient might benefit from pulmonary vasodilators rather than giving diuretics or even giving fluids. And giving fluids might actually further worsen the cardiac output by dilating the right ventricle, and which in turn causes interventricular septal flattening and further leading to drop in the cardiac output. So recently I had a patient who had very severe congestion, like VEXAS grade 3, all these veins were pulsatile, but still we did not give fluids and we didn't give diuretics in this case, because VEXAS automatically doesn't mean give diuretics to the patient or remove fluid. So this patient had a right heart catheterization on the same day, showing low pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. It was around 7 or 8. So we felt that like if you remove fluid from this patient, it would probably impair left heart filling, like you mentioned. That's a scenario I could envision where removing fluid might hurt left heart filling. So in that case, we just give pulmonary vasodilators and the patient gradually improved over the next few days, and even the renal function improved.
So there might be cases where we have to sort of overload the right heart to support the left, but it would probably be better to try to link up those functions so that there's no longer this big disconnect.
Right. It would be very weird to have like completely dissociated hemodynamic circuit. Ultimately, it's the same thing. The blood has to flow through.
Right. Outside of frank right heart failure, like that they have a PE or something like that. Now, so let's say somebody came to you and said, you know, I'm Dr. Maximally Invasive. I put a central line in. We're just going to measure the CVP. I put a Swan in. We're just going to measure the left side of filling pressures. Or maybe they're going to do some fancy ultrasound and measure filling pressures through those sorts of means. Maybe an RVSP, do some diastolic things on the left heart, and so on. And so they could say, I'm just going to write down all these pressures for you. What does it add to also look at the organs and their waveforms this way? Or is it a surrogate for these other measurements, or is it telling you something extra?
If the patient has a Swan, I wouldn't be too stressed about like performing a VEXAS on the same day. But most of the time, VEXAS helps. Like you can't keep the Swan forever, right? Like you'll keep it only for as long as the patient really absolutely needs it, when you're titrating a medication or the patient is like very critically ill. And after that, you have to remove. Once you remove, I would probably see what's the venous congestion at the time of Swan removal and continue to follow it. Basically, even in that scenario, VEXAS will help me to see how it is improving over time. And if it's improving or not, if the patient has residual congestion by the time he or she is going out of the ICU, what guidance should I give to floor doctors? Because not in every hospital you have floor doctors who are familiar with VEXAS or even like familiar with hemodynamics that you're talking about. So you need to give some guidance to them. So in that case, it would be helpful.
Do you think there are patients where even if, let's say, I know the CVP or the wedge pressure, that knowing the VEXAS scan at those numbers could add something? And maybe like these numbers look high, but like the organs are happy, or they look like they're not that high, but the patient looks congested.
Right. So both of these things can happen. Like I initially mentioned, with CVP, like VEXAS is better than CVP alone in terms of predicting organ function. So you don't always see these discordant things. Like if the CVP is 20, I would most likely expect that the VEXAS is severely abnormal. If the CVP is 7, I wouldn't expect VEXAS to be really abnormal, except for renal, probably because of the residual interstitial edema. And as when the patient initially came to the hospital, you probably overloaded them. And now the central venous pressure has reduced, but the interstitial edema hasn't. So apart from those situations, in extremes, it's probably not super helpful. But if you have some intermediate central venous pressure, like CVP of 10, 12, in those cases, it's hard to predict. The same thing like fluid responsiveness. Like in extremes, IVC is helpful. But when the patient is on like mid portions of the Frank-Starling curve, you cannot assess fluid responsiveness by knowing a central venous pressure. So same thing happens with VEXAS.
Now, you talked about using ultrasound of the internal jugular vein if you maybe can't get a good look at the IVC. Are you essentially just looking for kind of that point of collapse where the vein, sort of the pressure head is, much as you would do with a physical exam, looking for the highest point of the jugular vein distension?
Yeah. So internal jugular vein is typically used in scenarios where you cannot trust IVC or where you cannot access the vessel. It could be because of bandages or abdominal surgeries and so on. And scenarios where your IVC is unreliable is cirrhosis, like I mentioned. You have local structural alterations. You have hypertrophy of the caudate lobe, which can compress the IVC in that area where you would normally measure the diameter. Or you can have, in cirrhosis, you have these all these collaterals and IVC gets a lot of flow that is not usually accustomed to. So you can have a dilated IVC even without elevated central venous pressure. Anything can happen in cirrhosis. So in those patients, and also you can have, even in cirrhosis, you have ascites and increased intra-abdominal pressure, which would collapse the IVC despite having elevated right atrial pressure. So in those scenarios, you do internal jugular vein assessment. And as you mentioned, we look at the highest point of venous pulsations. In the case of ultrasound, where the vessel essentially collapses, or where you see the tapering or the wine bottle sign or paintbrush sign, whatever you want to call it, and see how high it is from the sternal angle and add the right atrial depth. And that's another controversy, is like we tend to add 5 centimeters as the right atrial depth, but it's not constant in everybody. And a recent study has shown that if you use a parasternal long axis view and estimate the right atrial depth on an individual patient basis, that's more accurate than just assuming it to be 5 centimeters.
Not a perfect tool, but probably at least as accurate approximating the right atrial pressure as looking at the IVC.
Yeah, it has its own pitfalls. I think mainly people are confused because of so many methods described in literature. One thing is the one we talked about, and the other things are like they go to the cricoid cartilage level and see by how much the vessel is collapsing with inspiration. And some studies say how much it is collapsing with a sniff and not regular inspiration. And some studies use Valsalva maneuver in patients who are cooperative and they can perform a Valsalva. You see by how much the vessel is getting bigger, and the bigger the vessel gets, the lower is the central venous pressure. So because like so many methods exist, and there can be confusion with the head angle. Is it should I do it in? Not more so with the highest point of venous pulsations method, but for rest of the diameter and collapsibility, like what should be my head angle? Is it 30 degrees or 45 degrees, and so on? And sometimes the patient has a lot of pillows. And recently, we observed a case where we recorded a like super high jugular venous pressure. When we asked the patient to rotate the head, we were looking at the right internal jugular vein and asked the patient to turn their head to the left, just for the ease of finding the vessel. But the vessel has collapsed at the angle of jaw, suggesting like very high right atrial pressure. But it did not correlate with the rest of the data. We looked at the inferior vena cava. It was not that big. We did VEXUS, and VEXUS was perfectly fine. It seemed a bit odd. So I went back and looked at the literature, like what can give this falsely high central venous pressure using JVP. Apparently, it turned out that you should not turn the patient's head to one side. And I again followed up and put the head in neutral position and did the scan. And we found that the vessel collapsed just like 2 centimeters above the clavicle. So it's probably that when the patient rotated their head, the neck muscles were working like a tourniquet to the jugular vein and causing its plethora or engorgement. So these kind of things can be tricky. So I always advocate for multi-organ assessment whenever possible.
I mentioned using some advanced echo techniques to get a better understanding of filling pressures. People will do things like approximate the RVSP as a marker of the PA pressures, or look at like the E to A or the E to E prime to get some idea for the wedge pressure. Do you think this can answer some of the same questions that you're answering with the VEXA scan and the IVC, or are they answering different questions, or is one more reliable than the other?
Yeah, I think it's again a continuity of the hemodynamic circuit we are assessing here, because some people can have pulmonary hypertension, moderate to severe, but they don't necessarily have a lot of tricuspid regurgitation. In patients, say, going to pulmonary hypertension clinic in the outpatient, they're pretty stable, compensated. They don't necessarily have elevated right atrial pressure. But a sick patient usually tend to have elevated RVSP, tricuspid regurgitation, and possibly elevated right atrial pressure. So it depends. It again varies from patient to patient. Just having a high RVSP does not guarantee you have a severe venous congestion. So it's important to measure both. I think the better way to think about it, like in the outpatient setting, we are doing a lot of, cardiology is doing a lot of cardio MEMS, which is a sensor. They put it in the pulmonary artery to monitor pressures remotely in outpatients. But one criticism is that like it does not necessarily mean you have elevated right atrial pressure or venous congestion. So you cannot, just because the pulmonary artery pressure increased, you don't know if the right atrial pressure has elevated or not. If the right atrial pressure is not elevated, it's probably not causing congestive organ injury, right? Should you act based on those numbers or not? So that's what about the right-sided parameters. And left-sided parameters like E prime, yeah, I mean, they're definitely helpful in some scenarios. If I use it, for example, when I'm not able to differentiate cardiogenic versus non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, that also doesn't... because you can have pre-existing lung disease or pulmonary fibrosis, or maybe the patient is just recovering from a pneumonia like our index patient, or the patient had a recent COVID infection and also has predisposing factors for cardiogenic pulmonary edema. If you think about a dialysis patient who had a COVID infection a few months ago, most of these dialysis patients, if you look at the hearts, there is like significant concentric LVH. And consequently elevated left-sided filling pressures. So it's very difficult to determine if they have cardiogenic versus non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema when they have a confounding factor. So in such cases, I use it. And also it's a tricky thing. In acute scenarios, you might not have elevated, enlargement of the left atrium. It takes some time, because that's one of the criteria for diastolic dysfunction assessment. And also, when you look at the EE prime, E is more load dependent as opposed to E prime. And it in intubated patients, I think it's been shown that E prime is probably the best predictor of filling pressures. So yeah, there are certain controversies and issues, but that again calls for a multi-parametric approach and not over-rely on individual parameters.
What about the femoral vein? Now, some people are doing Doppler here as kind of one more way to understand congestion. Do you find any utility here?
Yeah, so recently I got interested in femoral vein because of the studies that came out recently. But in general, it's just an extension of the three primary veins, hepatic, portal, and intrarenal. So if you're able to get, say, if the patient doesn't have cirrhosis, you can trust your hepatic and portal veins, I would just stop there. I'm not going to spend too much time on each patient. But in case I cannot trust hepatic vein or portal vein, or there is some discrepancy, then you could do femoral vein. Femoral vein is a little farther from the heart, so it might be less sensitive. That's what earlier studies suggest. It has relatively low sensitivity for detecting elevated right atrial pressure. So if the femoral vein waveform is relatively normal, I wouldn't stress. I wouldn't exclude venous congestion. But if the femoral vein is abnormal, then the patient most likely has venous congestion. Abnormal meaning more pulsed. Normally, it's usually continuous or has like mild pulsations. Like at the A wave or when the atrial contraction occurs, there is a little bit of dip in the waveform. But otherwise, in most patients, it's just continuous. It becomes more and more pulsatile, then I know I should assess further veins. So other common thing where you can see femoral veins, like the patients often get DVT scans, right? If you just open the images and you suddenly see that the vein is pulsatile, then I go and do VEXAS. That's also happened multiple times.
In what clinical scenarios or, you know, with what baseline conditions are these VEXAS measurements not reliable? I mean, are there confounders that may make you say, I can't trust one or all of these methods of evaluation and I got to go, you know, use some other tool?
Yeah, I cannot think of a condition where all the components are like unreliable. Because if there is a congestion, there is congestion, whether it's because of acute fluid overload or acute on chronic pressure overload or acute pressure overload, whatever that is, like, or mechanical ventilation with like super high peeps. Yeah, you can have congestion because of many things, but it still means that the organ flow is not normal. When you think about individual components, hepatic vein waveform might not be like completely trustworthy when you have cirrhosis, because in cirrhotic patients, it's blunted at baseline. Those S and D waves are not necessarily well-defined. And it's hard to say if the right atrial pressure is being transmitted to that waveform or not. And another well-known pitfall of hepatic vein waveform is if you don't use a simultaneous EKG, it's hard to distinguish between systolic and diastolic waves. And there are several instances where you would think a systolic wave is bigger than the diastolic wave, but when you put the EKG, you see the opposite. And there are also instances where I could have missed a systolic reversal if I did not have EKG, because Normally, if you know the length of the or the duration of the cardiac cycle, you won't miss, like if you have two waves below the baseline or one wave has reversed. But I had a patient who had a prolonged PR interval. In prolonged PR interval, you have a diastolic wave, and also and because of this prolongation, there is one more bout of blood going into the heart after the diastole. So it feels like you have like two waves there. And when the systolic wave reverses, you see a big wave above the baseline, and you still have like two waves in each cardiac cycle. So you would think the reversed big wave is the A wave instead of S wave. So that sort of things can happen. So EKG is a must, I would say, as much as possible, you should use it. And portal vein is probably unreliable in cirrhosis, where you have portal hypertension and arteriovenous connections leading to hazy flow, and it can be pulsatile at baseline in these patients, or sometimes the flow can be completely reversed. You can have hepato pedal flow, and intrarenal, first of all, technically it's challenging. It's hard to get a reliable trace in most critically ill patients. I wouldn't say most. I think the failure rate is, like, depending on the studies, which correlates with most of our experience, is about, say, 20 to 30% failure rate. And if the patient cannot hold their breath, it's hard to get a good waveform because the sample volume is moving away from the vessels. On the contrary, in the nephrology clinic or any clinic, you can actually get like very good tracings because the patient is able to follow the instructions. And you don't know what to do with the intrarenal waveforms in CKD. Because we have seen that in some patients with CKD 4 or 5, they can have abnormal waveforms at baseline. So yeah, every waveform has limitations, but I cannot think of a scenario where all of them can be like completely useless. Yeah, depending on that, you use femoral vein or you can use superior vena cava from the suprasternal or supraclavicular window. Basically, any systemic vein can be used to... In addition to VEXUS, when one or the other components is not reliable, we call that EVEXUS or extended VEXUS.
You said in cirrhotics, the portal vein may always be pulsatile, but if it does have a trend, that's still meaningful. So if it's pulsatile today and you take volume off and in 2 days it's less pulsatile, that still means what you think. But if you come back and it's still just as pulsatile, then you say, I don't know if that's just their baseline.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. We even like published a case to show that, because like some people tend to just... ignore hepatic and portal veins just because the patient has cirrhosis, but I think it's still reliable in some patients on a case-by-case basis. Most of the patients who have cirrhosis tend to have like recurrent hospitalizations, right? And whenever they have hospitalizations or even in the outpatient settings, they tend to have right upper quadrant Doppler done. So if you look at those images, you get some sense of like what their baseline is and how are they doing now.
So are you finding utility in this stuff in the outpatient world? I mean, it's a very different environment, of course, but you know, in many ways, there may not be as many other things to turn to. So someone you're following for CKD as an outpatient, I mean, gosh, I could imagine, I don't know if anyone's doing this, but if you're seeing dialysis patients and you can't decide, you know, how much they need off today, you just scan everyone. I mean, is there a role for all this? I'm sure there are issues with, you know, the resource needs and, because I mean, you're doing it yourself, right? So...
So in the outpatient setting, in the nephrology clinic, I think it's very useful. I have a cardiorenal clinic where the way it goes is like if the patient has a diagnosis of heart failure and somebody puts in a nephrology consult, the patient by default comes to me as long as I have opening. So in most such patients need a baseline assessment of congestion, whether it's venous congestion or pulmonary congestion. In the initial consult visit, like you have some time, like you have at least 30 minutes of time slot. So while talking to the patient, you can always perform a quick scan and document the baseline. And for the repeat visits, which are usually like about 20 minutes, you can just monitor only one parameter that you are supposed to monitor, or just not do focus if you don't need to. In dialysis patients, that's a different world. You have like 20, 24 dialysis patients sitting there, it's almost impossible to scan everybody. And they don't have always like secluded rooms. So it might be difficult to lift up their shirts and stuff when the other person is beside them. So I don't do a lot of focus, especially like VEXUS like things in the dialysis unit. I might scan some people's lungs. Even when I do, like similar 8-zone or 4-zone ultrasound. I mentioned this specifically because most of the literature in lung ultrasound utility in dialysis patients uses 28-zone lung ultrasound. But a couple of studies have shown that 8-zone is probably as accurate as 28 in terms of prognostic significance. So if at all I do only 8 zones. And if I'm able to catch the patient before they are put on the machine, so when they come for their shifts, like you can take them to a separate room and quickly scan and send them. You can't even like waste too much time because it's a lot of resource intense setting. It takes a lot of time if you delay the patient care.
We work in systems with others. So sometimes when we're doing more cutting edge things, just interfacing with other specialists and teams and providers can be challenging. So if you're seeing that hypotensive patient with an AKI and you look at all kinds of things and you say, we should take volume off this patient, and everyone goes, whoa, are you able to get your message across by referring to things like the VEXA scan, or do you get a lot of blank stares?
It depends. It totally depends on who you're talking to. Like most ICU attendings are, even if they don't do VEXAs, they're familiar with the concept. Floor attendings might not be, but floor attendings generally tend to trust you, right? Whatever the subspecialist says, the hospitalists generally trust you unless it's like totally against their assessment. Other good thing is that like we have image archiving system. So whatever we do, the report is in the chart, and why we are saying what we are saying, the rationale is always written in the report. And I even stick some important images in the note itself. I know you can have a link. We have a PACS link where anybody can see all the images that I perform. But for my satisfaction, I put like 2 or 3 key images showing that this patient's portal vein is 100% pulsatile. You can't give fluid to this patient, or like you have to remove a lot of fluid from this patient and so on. So I think image archiving indirectly helps not only for billing, but also for effective communication among teams.
Are you billing these as like an abdominal ultrasound or something like that?
Yeah, you have a limited code, like abdominal Doppler limited or something like that.
Whew, all right. Well, this has been just a crazy look at all this. I hope that there's kind of a spectrum of people listening. Some people are doing some of this, some who are interested, and some who just should be aware that it is out there. Brian, what else should we look at here?
Well, interesting that you say look, because I was just thinking that through this whole thing, I think the thing that has always confused me a little bit about VEXAS is, one, I've not done a whole lot of it. I'm doing more. But two, I think trying to learn it in a format like this, for me at least, is very hard. I'm get really confused sometimes just listening to instruction on this. So I'm a visual person, and your site has a lot of nice visual references and some video clips. So we'll link that in the show notes. But I think if people are out there like me who are going, man, I'm lost. This sounds cool, but I really don't feel like I could do this. Take a look at Abhilash's site because we'll link to it. But it's got a lot of good visual stuff. So if you're a visual person like me, I think it's helpful.
Yeah. Obviously there's a lot of just hands-on practicalities here if people want to actually learn this. But if nothing else, understanding kind of the clinical integration, because otherwise people may not know why they would even want to learn it. And that's still a question we're often asking. Why is this additional skill something that we need? So maybe this answers that question for at least some people. And there are a lot of great resources for those who want more. So.
And there are a lot of case reports also. I mean, in one of the recent posts on nephropocus.com, I put together like whatever cases we published, each has a distinct or unique teaching point and how VEXAS helped in the assessment. So it would probably help them to go through those cases.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there then. Thanks so much for joining us. Just a reminder to everyone, this is not medical advice, just some general educational content. I hope you're not using this alone to guide any of your medical care. And certainly we're not representing any of our own institutions here. We're just giving your own opinions. And we will talk to y'all next time.